My name is William, and you're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
The fact is that algorithms are the underlying technology of missile defense. Algorithms happen to be the perfect weapon for executing commands in real time to automated weapons over huge expanses of geography. Algorithms, which were shaped for war, now shape civilization writ large. Digital technologies blur any distinction between civil society and a military state that may have existed.
That's Kuhan Pakmander, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. Algorithms, the dictionary tells us, are a process or set of rules to be followed in calculations or other problem-solving operations, especially by computer. Sounds innocuous enough, but hang on, it has a dark side. Algorithms can make mistakes due to biases, poor design, coding errors, or flawed assumptions. They can collect and process large amounts of personal data, which can put people's privacy rights at risk. And there are lethal dangers. Kuhan Pakmander warns the algorithms that missiles have spawned have been a scourge on Mother Earth and our own humanity with our smartphones, satellites, robotics, and AI, and all the rest, through which civil society has unwittingly become militarized through and through. Our guest today is Kuhan Pakmander. She's a journalist, author, and peace and environmental activist. Her articles appear in The Nation, The Progressive, Foreign Policy in Focus, and other publications. And now, Kuhan Pakmander.
Our nation, the United States of America, continues to bankroll two horrible wars. One, an off-the-rails genocide in Gaza that has expanded into Lebanon, and the other one, a brutalization of Ukraine and Russia that has dragged on for years. And yet another one that is in the planning stages, which warmongers view as the big prize. And that is war with China. These wars are being conducted with unprecedented coordination and simultaneous recklessness. We're talking about satellite-based warfare driven by AI and executed through autonomous weapons that explode from the sky. It's as if the use of AI and drones is so fetishized by the warmongers that it blinds them to the genocide that results. You know, it may not be unlike the fetishization of the industrial trains and incinerators used by the Nazis during the 20th century. It's amazing that the transformation in the way wars are waged crystallized in the brief span of only 4 years that Joe Biden has been in office. Remember, Biden's opening move upon entering office was dispensing of that old school brick and mortar war in Afghanistan. This has Antony Blinken's fingerprints all over it. During the Trump years, Blinken busied himself by co-founding a consulting firm with Michel Flournoy called West Exec. They hired Jen Psaki, remember her? Avril Haines, who helped design Obama's program of using drones for extrajudicial killings, and she is now the current director of National Intelligence, and they hired David Cohen, now the deputy director of the CIA. They had all worked together in the Obama administration, And the mission of their company, WestExec, during the Trump years, was to create a new way of war for the 21st century by merging the products of legacy manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon with the technologies of Google, Palantir, the Israeli AI company Shield AI, Microsoft, and others, and then bid the new innovations for Pentagon contracts, the profits of which reached unprecedented heights. So it's time to play catch up with understanding the contours and characteristics of this new kind of warfare, which is based entirely on digital technologies. Only then can we as peace activists most specifically identify points of intervention for resistance. I first began thinking deeply about digital technologies during the 1980s. It all started in 1986 when I was led to Malibu by an old college friend to hang out with a guy whom I'll call Tom, with whom I had gone to film school. Little did I know that he would be my first husband. I confess, I was seduced by the plush digs along the Amalfi-like coast, overlooking the homes of Johnny Carson and Madonna, Shangri-La. Hanging prominently on the wall was Tom's self-portrait in acrylics. Painted on the canvas was a stream of color that shot out the top of his head like a rainbow fountain arcing into a small rectangle floating in space. "What's that?" I asked. "That's me. I'm downloading my brain onto a chip. Well, it wasn't until 4 decades later that I can now look back and realize that my soon-to-be first husband was an early prototype of a Tescrealist. Tescreal, that's an acronym. It stands for transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. The acronym was coined by Google pariah Timnit Gebru and journalist Emil Torres. It refers to the techno-utopian cocktail of ideologies to which Silicon Valley's most powerful billionaires subscribe and which are rooted in misanthropic ideas of cybernetics and eugenics. Downloading brains onto chips is one of them. It was an oddly amoral time of my youth, so I happily turned a blind eye to the implication of Tom's wealth being owed to a fat stipend he had gotten from Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative to develop artificial intelligence at Carnegie Mellon University. At first, I was mesmerized as Tom regaled me with visions of the magical future that was coming. As an example, he described how business meetings in the future would take place between people who were on entirely different continents, but in real time, sort of like this Zoom meeting. They'd be wearing goggles that would make them appear as if they were all gathered in the same three-dimensional space, like a conference room. If someone at the meeting were to type up on a paper on a virtual typewriter in this virtual space, they'd be able to roll up that sheet of type paper from the machine and pass it on to someone else at the meeting, who'd then be able to hold it within the virtual space and read what was typed. And none of it was in the real world. It only existed in the virtual world. In hindsight, wasn't it quaint that typewriters were included in this high-tech vision for the future? But we had no way of knowing that they'd soon be relics of the past. After a while, we moved to Pittsburgh to be near campus. We lived in a de facto frat house for STEM nerds. My roommates could have easily been 20-something versions of Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Bezos, and Sam Altman. They were all into colonizing Mars. On the walls were lots of the first photos ever taken on the red planet, the ones that had been made famous by Life magazine. They also had a predilection for what they saw as cute robots in the movies and on television, the same way that some folks were a pushover for puppies. I chalked it up to the popularity of the iconic television series Star Trek, which was viewed religiously by my generation. They were immersed in the popular culture zeitgeist of the time, such as William Gibson novels, tie-dyed t-shirts, and psychotropic drug use, camouflaging the very specific necro culture that was then in its R&D phase. The value system at the root of it all was war in space. But I rationalized, how can anyone into Timothy Leary and Terrence McKenna and Are You Serious's High Frontiers magazine possibly be dangerous? They were there to learn rocket science, or more specifically, missile warfare. You know, Star Wars stuff. Discussion of multi-megaton blasts consistently elicited a certain glee in them that I confess I found unsettling. When I was 9, my parents had taken me to the Hiroshima Museum, an experience that traumatized me for life. I mean, that a single bomb could cause the flesh inside the arms of thousands of survivors walking in an aimless stupor immediately after the blast to melt within still intact bags of skin dangling where arms once hung and then unspool to the ground as dark liquid out of all 10 fingertips was unspeakably horrific. The temperatures were so hot that rice buried underground for protection in glass jars melted and fused with their containers. Days after the blast, people's hair would mysteriously fall out by the fistful. I'll never forget the head of a lady's hair framed behind glass and hanging on the museum wall like a flattened tumbleweed. After that visit to Hiroshima, where the museum curators had so mindfully delivered the grave message of atomic weapons, I presumed that the world now knew that dropping such a bomb was an atrocity tantamount to the Holocaust. I left the museum naively confident that people would never, ever let such crimes against humanity happen again. And yet, these Carnegie Mellon lads, thrilled at the promise of one day wielding such Promethean power. Apparently, I was living with emotional adolescence, getting comfortable for the first time with the hubris of their colonial forefathers. The universe was their oyster, and they reveled in the fact that they had been given the educational tools by government and academia to create weapons that could destroy it all, if they so chose. I found this to be utterly alien. By contrast, I had grown up on the margins of empire, on the Korean Peninsula, which the U.S. had divided in order to keep a military foothold in Asia. Another significant part of my childhood took place on the spectacularly beautiful island of Guam, which was and still is a projection of U.S. military might so far flung that it is on the Asia side of the international dateline. All the license plates possessively proclaimed, "Where America's day begins." In the last couple of decades, the gem-like island has been garrisoned to the hilt for the anticipated war with China, in which it would likely be the first casualty, slaughtering scores of dear friends. China even named one of its bombs the Guam Killer. This is the background that drives my demilitarization activism today. But back at Carnegie Mellon, I learned a new dialect, a new language, using weird terms such as epsilon to refer to an infinitesimal amount, or delta to talk about a difference, torus when ordering donuts, the Turing test, logic analysis, hexadecimal, algorithms, and more. I'd never heard of these terms before living in Pittsburgh. When I asked Tom what an algorithm was, he said it's a software program. The American Heritage Dictionary defines algorithm as, quote, a finite set of unambiguous instructions that, given some set of initial conditions, can be performed in a prescribed sequence to achieve a certain goal that has a recognizable set of end conditions, end quote. The operative fact is that algorithms are the underlying technology of missile defense. Computers had emerged at the birth of the Cold War as the most effective means of, quote, containing, end quote, rival hegemons. The idea was to build capabilities to monitor and arm the entire planet before Russia did, and China as a threat came later. Algorithms happened to be the perfect weapon for executing commands in real time to automated weapons over huge expanses of geography. Tom and his buddies at the Carnegie Mellon Computer Science Department had been charged with developing the early algorithms, AI and robotics, to create a kind of dome of missile protection over the entire United States. In his 1996 book, The Closed World, Computers and the Politics of Discourse in Cold War America, Paul Edwards wrote that computers, with their algorithmic technologies, are both machines and metaphors for the politics and culture of Cold War America. He gives a broad historical overview, and I quote, "As machines, computers controlled vast systems of military technology central to the globalist aims and apocalyptic terms of Cold War foreign policy. First air defenses, then strategic early warning and nuclear response, and later the sophisticated tactical systems of the electronic battlefield grew from the control and communications capacities of information machines, of computers. As metaphors, such systems constitute a dome of global technological oversight, a closed world within which every event is interpreted as part of a titanic struggle between the superpowers. Inaugurated in the Truman Doctrine of Containment, elaborated in Rand Corporation theories of nuclear strategy, tested under fire in the jungles of Vietnam, and resurrected in the impenetrable peace shield of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, the key theme of closed world discourse was global surveillance and control through high technology military power," end quote. Edwards' words conjure images of Israel's Iron Dome and Lavender AI as a continuation of the closed world he talks about. And he continues, and I quote, "Both the engineering and the politics of closed world discourse centered around problems of human-machine integration, that is, building weapons, systems, and strategies whose human and machine components could function as a seamless web, even on the global scales and in the vastly compressed time frames of superpower nuclear war," end quote. And here, with the research into human-machine integration, also called cybernetics, we see the origins of the current crazy fad to merge one's brain with a silicon chip. It was seen as a way to minimize human decision-making in warfare, but it's gone even further than that. Last May, a Swiss company claims to have built a computer made from living human brain tissue. Algorithm technologies, which were developed for military enclosure and the centralization of control, have now fully permeated civilian life, creating Edwards's dome of global surveillance and control. But it's less a dome, per se, than it is full-on saturation. And the controlling forces are no longer the Pentagon, but the tech industry. In fact, nowadays, it's big tech that calls the shots, even over the Pentagon. The human-machine integration that was engineered as a Cold War strategy now inhabits our daily life, from Facebook to surveillance doorbells to computers made of human brains. The function of all these applications, regardless of ostensible purpose, whether it be to check your blood pressure, teach you a foreign language, monitor climate change, program robot taxis, whatever. The real purpose, the primary purpose, is to shift wealth and power from the many into a few hands in Silicon Valley. This is the primary purpose. It is the essence of disruption. One of the most venal uses of AI that I've heard of lately is called, quote unquote, personalized pricing. But David Dayen, who wrote about it in American Prospect, more aptly describes it as surveillance pricing. Companies want to get their apps on your phone and get your data and then set prices according to what they learn about you. Once a company's on your phone, the AI can figure out when your payday is, your medical data, your travel dates, anything that goes through your phone. The McDonald's app is on the phone of 50 million people. So it might send out ads for Happy Meals on a daughter's birthday or double Big Macs on payday or for the new line of fresh salads if you've been rushed to emergency for a heart attack. Because it's so-called personalized, the pricing is variable depending on the highest amount that the algorithm determines from all your data that it can ask from specifically you. Basically, companies have superimposed the capitalist economic system and goals over the networked infrastructure originally developed for hegemonic warfare, and the fit is hand in glove. Imagine how it will be once insurance companies, government agencies, and more corporations get on your phone, especially with the rollout of all the new smart appliances, cars, smart gas pumps, smart public sensors for facial and voice recognition, etc., and they'll all be networked together. It will result in a vast power imbalance that will ever widen with every move you make. The technocracy will know everything about us, and we will know nothing about them. Algorithms, which were shaped for war, now shape civilization writ large. Digital technologies blur any distinction between civil society and a military state that may have existed. It's no coincidence that a former general and head of the National Security Administration was recently appointed to the board of the private company OpenAI. But I'm getting ahead of myself again. Back at Carnegie Mellon, it started to dawn on me that the household of boys I lived with were designing a new kind of weapon of mass destruction. But they didn't see it that way. As far as they were concerned, we were going through a golden age of algorithm development enabled by the hundreds of millions of dollars being pumped into SDI research. They were developing such innovations as machine vision for autonomous vehicles, robotics, voice recognition, microchip memory storage. These were tools that would help humanity. That's what they told themselves. They saw the world through the blinkered lens of discrete applications, as if keeping their heads in the sand somehow rendered their actions morally neutral. They refused to see the big picture. Astonishingly, they held no difference, let alone moral discrepancy, between a robot tank developed to launch torpedoes at civilians versus a robot taxi on the streets of San Francisco. They only worked on the algorithms. That's how they saw it. If the ultimate goal was weapons of mass destruction, it wasn't necessarily so, they rationalized. They emotionally externalized any considerations of ethics. I began to harbor a vague resentment that this very narrow tranche of acne-challenged humanity with very limited life experience and no moral compass whatsoever had been charged by fate with shaping how life would be experienced for the whole world in the future, from consequential decisions such as programming voting machines to an infinite array of mundane choices that have since become the wallpaper of our lives. You know, how menus would drop down, whether to single click or double click, and other not so intuitive decisions that eventually became familiar conventions of online functionality. I mean, who gave them the entitlement to shape our future? And if they succeeded in shaping this future into their own image, ugh, how flat and thin and uninteresting that would be. And now, here we are. Tom once said to me, "Remember that movie, Revenge of the Nerds?" "It's coming true," he explained. "We'll control everything. That's our revenge." He smiled matter-of-factly. Indeed, we both knew that every human activity outside bodily functions would soon be reduced to a keyboard, screen, and mouse, or a device these days. Once that were to happen, the world will have been successfully reformatted to a new closed world system in which the coders, the programmers, called the shots, leaving the rest of society perplexed and helpless. Even the politicians, the generals, the bankers. Tom and his colleagues were hell-bent on maintaining a nerds-only world order. This was revealed in a little game they would play. As part of earning their PhDs, they were required to TA in a high school math class. They would choose during the first week of the semester which student they wanted to score the highest grade in the class by the end of the semester. Invariably, they would choose a kid whom they deemed to be the finest young white male nerd in the class. And at the end of the semester, they would write an algorithm that would supposedly prove to the rest of the class why their favored student was the one to receive the highest grade. Looking back, knowing what I know now about how AI optimizes for certain results, I can see that I was witnessing an early abuse of algorithms to undermine meritocracy. But really, it's what they were built for. I was aghast by this game, which was actually a sort of exercise in narcissism and a very early example of the sort of inherent race bias in algorithms that is currently making headlines. The deal breaker in our marriage came the moment that Tom disclosed to me the classified project he'd been working on that required a secret code to get in and out of a building that manufactured military tanks. His PhD project involved designing a remotely operated tank that could be controlled from anywhere, say a couch in Topeka, Kansas, to kill people across the planet, say in the Middle East. Nowadays, this sort of drone technology is tragically commonplace. But back in the 1980s, before we even used the word drone like this, when violence was far less a part of our everyday life than it is today, to hear about this project was frankly beyond terrifying. Tom explained with self-assurance how superior such a weapon was because your adversary was helpless to fight back. The enemy could be pulverized by the armaments mounted on your tank. The calmness with which he explained it made it even creepier. I felt like Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby, who marries into Satan's family without knowing it, and then finds out only after it's too late that she's carrying the devil's spawn. I filed for divorce within 2 weeks. From all I had seen, it was not outside the realm of possibility that these apocalyptic technologies might overtake civilian society if consumer applications were allowed to move forward unregulated. It might seem harmless enough to be able to pay bills or order a taxi via the internet, or even noble to be able to task robots instead of humans to clean up a hazardous waste site. But all technologies carry with them a system of values, and these were no different. Military values of domination and control and surveillance are embedded in algorithmic technologies. I wondered, what exactly are the operative characteristics of digital technologies that make them uniquely suited for war? If these technologies, in the form of spin-off applications, were to pervade society, what would the implications be? I asked myself, I mean, would human civilization become inexorably authoritarian without even knowing what hit it, distracted and seduced by all the techno-utopian promises?
You're listening to Kuhan Pakmander on algorithms, digital technologies, and warfare. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
I've been agonizing over these and similar questions.